Yeah, we got one more, and this is the fourth. Tonight will be the fourth account of him describing the fall of Nineveh. So there are four times he describes the events. Because, I mean, I've got that map on there, and you remember when we went around there the first time that he was, you know, the chariots were flashing back and forth, running through the streets. They kept moving in on the palace area. Well, now we're gonna do it again. He's gonna see it from a different angle, a different perspective, and. So we're in chapter 3, looking in verse 11 through 19. Hopefully we'll end, close the book down tonight. One thing, you know, you wonder what this chapter 3, verse 5 and 6. Last week we just kind of went through the verses 8 through 10 talking about Thebes, the fall of Thebes. But the week before that, we read these verses, and it's kind of hard to imagine. I'm going to use this as an illustration. I hope I'm not offensive with it, or, you know, especially in our political climate. But in chapter 3, verse 5, the Lord is speaking to Nineveh. He says, "I am against you, declares the Lord Almighty. I will lift your skirts over your face. I will show the nations your nakedness, and the kingdoms your shame. I will pelt you with filth. I will treat you with contempt and make you a spectacle. All who see you will flee from you and say, 'Nineveh is in ruins. Who will mourn for her?'" And then what happened at the Capitol this last week, it was kind of like, as I was, you know, you're hearing and watching the events, and it's kind of like, well, that's what it would be like if the nation's skirt was lifted up and the nation saw it and the Lord's just throwing filth at the nation. It's like, what a disgrace. It's like, and that's not the greatest example. I mean, there's a higher level of the nation being overrun. But for America, what happened at the Capitol, that was just kind of like with cameras and videotape and social media and the mainstream media, here's the United States Capitol just being overrun by, you know, I mean, nobody. I mean, it's just like some clowns. And it's like nothing could be more of just your nakedness being exposed and something like that. And it's kind of like that. You know, when you read that, he's like, what would that look like? How was God going to expose the nakedness? Well, as I was looking at that, I mean, it was kind of embarrassing. It was kind of like shameful. It's like, oh, my gosh. And everybody else is looking at the shame of America. And so it's like, again, it could get a lot worse than that. But that verse kind of popped out. It's like, this is, again, that was my take. That's not like, thus says the Lord, or I didn't get that out of some scholarly book. That was just me watching the events and going, this must be what it means when the Lord says, I'm going to lift your skirt up over your head and expose your nakedness. This is how weak they are and how contemptible they are. Okay, then last week we read through a lot of details about Thebes and Egyptian history and kind of came up with, you know, the background of the Assyrian assault by Ashurbanipal in 663 in Thebes. And now I think the book is written, this book, as we talk about, 645, during Ashurbanipal's, during the decline. It started already declining, and these events will take place in 612 B.C., where the fall of Nineveh. And by this time, this mighty military nation, empire, with Tiglath-Pileser and Shalmaneser, Sargon, Sennacherib, Esarhaddon, they were just conquering wherever they want to go. Ashurbanipal, like we've talked about, had marched his army 1,600 miles from Nineveh to Thebes and then carried stuff back 1,600 miles. Not just trinkets, but pillars. I mean, monuments. He carried it back. And so they definitely are controlling and dominating. But by the halfway point, even the art, I was looking at some books on Assyrian, the carvings on their wall. Ashurbanipal many times didn't go to battle. These guys are out leading the battle. They're out in front. I mean, they're the ones leading the charge. Ashurbanipal, he thought the goddess had told him, you're not supposed to go to war. You stay back and send the troops. And so he stayed back, and the image that you see at about the halfway point is he's living a life of luxury. He's got people bringing him food, and he's lounging. And these pictures of him killing lions, they're a lot of times they're actually in like coliseums, or they're in. There's a picture of one time of a man, a young man, standing on a cage, lifting up the gate, and a lion is coming out, and Ashurbanipal is standing there with some bodyguards, and he's shooting the lion as it comes out of the cage. So a lot of these images of him killing lions are more like Colosseum events, not like he's out fighting the wild. They're like capturing these lions, bringing them into him. Okay, king, it's time to go kill some lions and show that you are still in charge. And he goes out, and the crowd would gather around. They'd let a lion out. They'd have bodyguards around just in case things got out of control. And then he would shoot the lion, and then they'd make a carving of it. Even carving it to the place that you knew that he was in some kind of a coliseum. So my point, by the time we get through this, these guys are becoming weaker. They're becoming very soft. They're enjoying the luxuries. They don't leave the palace. They don't leave the city. And they just keep piling things. They got gold. They got silver. They got all the treasures of the other empires or countries that they brought in. And now we're into the final verses, Nahum chapter 3, verse 11 through 19. I'll read through them. And you can kind of hear that in these verses. And it's some of the stuff that I'll read you tonight, it's kind of scary. When you realize what the people were going through as their city was being overrun. And again, there's a map there of the city of Nineveh that we've drawn there. And that kind of shows you where the palace is at, and shows you the Tigris River, and then a canal running through the city. And all the gates that are named that are there, and this has been excavated. Remember, within a few years, a couple hundred years, by the time the Greeks got here, they did not know where Nineveh was. They marched right over it, right past it. They didn't know what it was. It was lost in history. It was so thoroughly destroyed in 612 that, like I said several weeks ago, even the excavator that excavated it says, if we hadn't found these things, like the male-headed, winged bull cherubs, Lamassus, I think is how you say it. They said, if we hadn't found this, we never would have believed the legends, the stories that were told by the historians about how great Nineveh was. We never would have believed it. Oh, it's my phone. I had a load of lumber being delivered today, and I couldn't miss the phone call. Yeah, I'm sorry. That would have gone all night. So I always have my phone on silence just because the only people I talk to on the phone is my wife. So either I call her or she calls me. But today I was getting a load of lumber. I couldn't miss the phone call. So anyway, here we go. I'll read it to you right now. Chapter 3, verse 11 to the end of the book. Nahum says to Nineveh, "You too will become drunk. You will go into hiding and seek refuge from the enemy. All your fortresses are like fig trees with their first ripe fruit. When they are shaken, the figs fall into the mouth of the eater. Look at your troops. They are all women. The gates of your land are wide open to your enemies. Fire has consumed their bars." Now, that's how he described it. There's five things. We'll go back and look, and there's five figures that he used to describe how weak and frail you are. Now he describes what it's going to be like when that weak, frail people are invaded. He says, verse 14, and there's three things that take place in these verses 14 through 18. Draw water for the siege. Strengthen your defenses. Work the clay. Tread the mortar. Repair the brickwork. There the fire will devour you. The sword will cut you down and like grasshoppers consume you. Multiply like grasshoppers. Multiply like locusts. You have increased the number of your merchants till they are more than the stars of the sky. Meaning your local businesses. You brought in so many businesses that this is like the stars. like the locusts, they strip the land and then fly away. Your guards are like locusts, your officials like swarms of locusts that settle in the walls on a cold day. But when the sun appears, they fly away, and no one knows where. O king of Assyria, your shepherds slumber, your nobles lie down to rest. Your people are scattered on the mountains with no one to gather them. Nothing can heal your wound. Your injury is fatal. Everyone who hears the news about you claps their hands at your fall. That means applauds. For who has not felt your endless cruelty or your endless evil? So here we go. I've got on the notes there at the top of page one, five images are given to indicate how fragile the Nineveh would be. The first is going to be a drunk. The next is going to be a refugee, a hiding refugee. The next is a ripe fruit, and that is that it's hanging on a branch, and it's so ripe, it just, you bump the branch, it falls off. It's ready to fall. It's ready to be picked. A woman, and this right here, again, we cannot comprehend this illustration in modern America, in the age of wokeness, political correctness. I have to explain this to the people. But in the real world, women are not equal to men. In the real world, women aren't capable of doing the same physical things a man can do. I know this makes no sense to America, because what a man can do, a woman can do. And likewise, what a woman can do, a man can do. A woman can have a baby, well, so can a man. And we're proving that. We're so advanced. But back in reality, you don't send women into battle for obvious reasons. Unobvious to Americans, because if a man can do it, a woman can do it. But if that were the case, historically, there would be women warriors. Now, again, you've got the Amazons and stories like that. But when the Greeks met the Assyrians, or when the Persians met the Babylonians met the Assyrians met the Egyptians, they didn't send their women out first. They put their women inside and sent their men out. So this is an insult. This is talking about how weak this mighty Assyrian people has become. It's like attacking women as troops. They put their best women out front. It's like, you're kidding, we're fighting a military of women? Yep. Anyway, that has to be explained over and over, because, like, why would they insult women? They're not insulting women. They're insulting the Assyrian military that you're, like, fighting women. Yeah. Okay. It doesn't matter anymore. We're past wokeness. We're in the place of stupidity. So it's time to start explaining this, because there's going to be either a total collapse or there's going to be some kind of a rebound, and these are going to have to be explained to people. We'll see what happens. And then open gates. And the open gates is an example of they're supposed to be closed. They're supposed to be there for protection, but your gates are open. So here we go. Chapter 3, verse 11, you also will be drunken. I'm reading now on the notes in the English Standard Version. You will go into hiding. You will seek a refuge. You will seek refuge from the enemy. And here are the first ones. So those are the first two. The drunk right here is a person that is drunk. They're not logical. They can't think. They can't come to logical conclusions, nor do they have the physical ability to move, to be steady. So Nineveh, during this time in 612, beginning halfway through Ashurbanipal's reign, they began to be basically a drunk person, a drunk nation. They're not thinking logically. They're not making good decisions. They're not stable. And to attack them would be like attacking a drunk person. There's no resistance. And any resistance they put up is futile. It's silly. It makes no sense. The next thing you see there on the notes is this drunkenness in this text of Scripture. This drunkenness comes on a people from God. It's the wrath of God. Now, this is interesting, because you could say they're illogical. They're drunk on their idolatry. They're drunk on their false philosophy. They're drunk on, like, you could look at our culture. It's like we've got bad philosophy. We're illogical. We're in the postmodern era. Age. We're like, nothing makes sense. And so we could say that it's philosophy, for example. or our culture or our religion, whatever, it's no longer logical. But the thing is, in Scripture, it doesn't say their philosophy or their worldview is causing them to be drunk. It says God's wrath is making them drunk. In other words, when God becomes upset with the people or is disappointed or ready to overthrow people, this philosophy is something that he can put into, he'll use and just make the people, so he'll hide the truth from them. In other words, they will go into, Romans chapter 1 and 2. He hands them over to the darkness of their heart. And thinking to be wise, they became foolish. And so the wrath of God, that's Romans chapter 1, the wrath of God is being revealed throughout history. And how he reveals his wrath is, okay, go ahead, think this way. He gives you, and that's like even at the end times it talks about in Thessalonians, he'll hand them over to the delusion, give them to a delusion because they've rejected the truth. Well, here, you like this? Makes sense? Oh yeah, that makes sense. And so what that the false philosophy, even in our own culture, the false philosophy we see circulating in our culture is actually the wrath of God, or could be the wrath of God. Where he's like, here, drink this, and you see that I've got another verse. Revelation 14, 9 through 10. And another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast and its image and receives the mark on his forehead or on his hand, he also will drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And again, that's two times in history. He's going to give them the wine of his wrath. You're going to go after this beast, this false thinking. Okay, I'll let you drink this, and it's just going to make you like a drunkard. You won't be logical. You won't be able to think. You won't be balanced. And because you've gone this way in time, your result is going to be eternal damnation or judgment. Jeremiah 25, 16 through 17. Thus the Lord, the God of Israel, said to me, take from my hand this cup of the wine of wrath, and make all the nations to whom I send you drink it. They shall drink and stagger and be crazed because of the sword that I am sending among them. In other words, Jeremiah was to go, in this example, was to take them a cup of this wrath. And if we put this all together, that cup, what was that cup? That cup would be the way of thinking. He's handing them over here. Give them this. Let them drink this. Let them drink their own human logic. And let them just get drunk on that. Anyway, that is what the Assyrians are like, a drunken person. And it could be, when we tie this together, we could spend more time on the wrath and the drunkenness as we develop. But that's something that is similar in prophecy. The next thing, and this we're going to see coming up again later, and it makes sense. We've already laid the foundation for this. It says, you will go into hiding, you will seek refuge from the enemy. So the people of Nineveh, which are in that great city, far away from their enemies, behind walls, surrounded with water, well protected, provisions that we're going to read later in this chapter. There's markets, there's so many merchants, everybody's coming to Assyria to sell, buy and sell. These people are going to be refugees. They're going to be running and hiding. We've already read about the dead bodies in the streets, the dead bodies that they're climbing over dead bodies as the Babylonians are pursuing into the city. They've got to climb over the dead bodies, are slowing them down because they got so many dead people. Not everybody gets killed. Some of them are going to end up fleeing the city. And when they flee, they're going to end up in the mountains. They're going to end up running from, as you come across, we looked at the map, Asher had fell a few years before. See, Asher's down below. Asher fell, what was it, 614. Nineveh, and so that moved as Babylon came. Then Nineveh fell in 612. They all ran to Haran. They made that the new capital. They found a new king. Here's your new king over here, the Asher-Ubalet. They set up a new government, a new king, trying to rebuild. That fell in 610. They fled what was ever left of them, fled into Carchemish, where Nebuchadnezzar finished them off in 605. And that's you went from Asher, Nineveh, Haran, Carchemish. That's the government trying to hold itself together, that we're still a people. But every time they fell, people would flee into the mountains with nowhere to go. I mean, they're not like running to another city. They're just running, hiding, trying to get out of the war zone. And so eventually by in 605, everybody's either dead or what's ever left, they've just scattered. And Assyria's no more. It's gone. They're gone. They whatever was left, the people that were left, were just, you know, blended in with somebody else, and they are no more. And so they are fleeing like a refugee. This great city, the people, are basically now become refugees trying to find some place to hide. The ripe fruit. You got to go to page 2 to see this. I've got all those numbers written down right there on page 2. I could have just turned the page and showed it to you. You know, those are all the dates that I just gave you. Chapter 3, verse 12. All your fortresses are like fig trees with first ripe figs. If shaken, they fall into the mouth of the eater. So this right here, the ripe fruit is how the fortresses are. The fortresses are, there would be fortresses around the city of Nineveh, even maybe in the walls, you know, the towers, if you want to call that a fortress, and outside as they, you know, defense areas watching the enemy coming. And all the way from Ashur down there, all the fortresses all the way. As they were approached by the Babylonians, it's like going up to a, not a fortress that's you can't get into, that's locked up like a fortress. It's like going up to a fruit tree that's got ripe fruit, and you like bump it, it all just falls, all the fruit just falls into the mouth of the eater. It's like you just shake the tree and eat the fruit and just keep right on going. The fortresses were falling as easily as fruit falls off a tree. So when the Babylonians come to a fortress, they're like, boo. They open the doors, take it, there's zero resistance. It's like if you picked an apple off a tree and that was ripe, there's no resistance. You just take it. So the fortresses had zero resistance all the way up to Nineveh, and even as they came into Nineveh, they're like ripe fruit. That's how weak they are. Their fortresses are as strong as ripe fruit. They just fell into the mouth of the eater. And the mouth of the eater would be Nabopolassar, Nebuchadnezzar's father. Now he's the one leading the military at this time, and he's the eater. All these fortresses just fall into Nabopolassar's mouth. Chapter 3, verse 13. Behold, your troops are women in your midst. I mean, I've already talked about that. That's what it means. It's like, well, what they actually mean, these were not good people. They were not treating women fairly. No, every one of these is a good, true example. They're like a drunken. You can't fight. You're like a refugee. You have no place to go. You're like ripe fruit. You collapse. You just fall into the mouth of the eater. You're like a soldier that's a woman. You can't fight the Babylonians if you're a woman. I mean, it's like, what are you going to do with this? We get to this postmodern era. We won't even be able to understand. Well, they were anti-women. No, they were trying to protect their women. The women didn't go on the front lines, even in the military, because that's not where women go. Women are protected. Let's just wait to see how this all ends. I'll just hold my ground, and we'll see how this ends. And maybe someday I'll say, you know what? Women can run a quarter mile faster than a man. Women should be pitching in the major leagues. Women are, we'll see. Who with steroids? Who knows? Okay. But anyway, that whole point there, I mean, it doesn't, you have to apologize for that verse, but I'm not. Your troops are like fighting women. The Assyrians at this time were weak. Next. The gates of your land are wide open to your enemies. Fire has devoured your bars. And so the last thing, the gates, which are a form of protection, when you come up to the gates, they're like wide open. There's no gate. It's just open. You just walk on in. Now, we're not saying they opened the gates. The gates were closed and barred, but it was as if they were open. They were that little resistance. And we're going to spend some time on the concept of the gates here. It's going to come up again later. But as we look at the gates here, the gates would be, let me just read the notes here. Behold, your troops are women. The gates of your land are wide open to your enemies. Fire has devoured your bars. So again, I've got a point one talk about women right there. It's used several times in Scripture. Two, the gates. Gates would be wooden panels with a bronze strip binding their edges. So if you came up, here'd be your wall, your block wall of some sort right here. And then you're going to have a metal frame, somehow a metal frame going around this, holding your wooden door, your wooden gate, and there'd be now wood panels in here. And sometimes the whole thing is covered with metal, depending on how you made them. So you got a wooden door with a metal frame just kind of holding, otherwise the wood splits and things. And then if you're on the inside, there'd be some kind of a stone here, or some kind of a holder here, where you could take and drop in a beam. A wooden bar would go across here that would just sit right here in this. And now you'd shut your door and drop the bar down, and now you can't get in because this is so well protected. You got the wall. You got a thick wooden door that's got a beam going behind it. Do you understand the image right there? Okay. Then now, I'm going to show you these things. Gates would be wooden panels with a bronze strip binding their edges. The wooden panel was attached on the top to a large wooden post that pivoted in the stone socket on the bottom, while the top of the post pivoted in the lintel that ran across the door. So up on top of here, this would have some kind of a post in this frame right here. And down here, there'd be some kind of a post right here. Up here, there'd be a lintel. Again, you'd maybe want to make the wall higher. Like, especially this would be, if we were to do this, let me do this right here. I'll do this like this. Because this would be more, if this is, I'm not sure what this looks like out there in the real world. But right here, it's a masterpiece right here in my little world. And you'd have all the bricks, the blocks, the stone. But this would be one massive stone right here built into the wall. And there'd be a hole cut in here for it to pivot the post. And down here would be a stone with a hole cut in it for the gate to swing. It'd pivot in here in the lintel, and it'd pivot right there. So that's how it would open. The wooden gate in the temple of Bellawart, which is 17 miles southeast of Nineveh. So you see Nineveh, you go 17 miles southeast. Was 20 feet tall. They excavated, found it was 20 feet tall. And they know this not because they found a 20-foot tall wooden door, because it would be gone. The wood's gone. They found the 20-foot tall frame where the wood was. When they were excavating, it had fallen in, and they found this metal frame where the wood was. And so that's, I mean, imagine a 20-foot tall gate that's just southeast of Nineveh. Now, turn the page, and I've got a picture, some pictures I took at Dan. Dan, that would be up here in this Israel, northern Israel. It was overtaken by the Arameans or the Syrians. And what you see right here, look at the big picture first. And I've got at the bottom, in the middle of the page, I got a circular socket cut in stone. That's what's left of the gateway. You can see on the back here, you can see three chambers back here. And it's all collapsed, but you can see like little rooms. That's where the elders would meet, or they'd have official meetings. Business would be taken care of there. There'd be gates on the other side of there. When you go through the gate of the city, it'd be like almost like a room. You'd walk in, there'd be like an entrance gate, and then you'd get into the gate and there'd be rooms where the elders would meet. You see this in the Bible. You sit with the elders in the gates, and then there'd be like the protective gate. And this is just the remains of it. And if you go up there to the top, I've got two little pictures. I've zoomed in on it, and you can see a circular stone, especially the one on the top right. You can see the circular stone, this stone right here. Can you see that stone right there? And then there's a hole in the middle. That's where this post would swing. And that's an actual, from this time period. This is 800 BC, 700 BC, 600 BC, when this gate was functioning. Yeah, exactly. Yep. And then there's a stone around it. Exactly. And there's you can see, now again, if you go online and look at it, you can see it better. This is a black and white printed. And it's, you know, you can actually even see it on the big picture. You can see it there. You can see it, what you're looking at. But if you're online, it's real obvious, I think. And again, I put in there, these pictures are actually on my website. It says the final most inner gate of the city with its final series of chambers. Note a socket cut out of stone where one of the sides of the gate doors would have been pivoted. Now, this verse is talking about this burning right here, and then when this beam is put down, that's going to get burnt also. So I'm going to go back. It's the page 3, bottom it says, the bars, once the wooden gate was shut, a horizontal bar would be laid across the inside of the wooden gate to keep them shut. So now I'm going to go back and read the verse. chapter 3, verse 13, your gates of your land are wide open to your enemies. Fire has devoured your bars. When it says devoured your bars, it means this right here. The fire would have burnt through this. They would have been beaten on this. And this bar itself has been burnt. So this wooden panel is gone. And this wooden bar is gone. And so they're just people just walking straight in. That's what, when it says bar, that's what it's referring to. Okay, I'm going to page 4. And I just got at the top there, ancient gateways. Again, that picture I've got at Dan is not like, it's not like the only time that's been found. And whenever you find a gate, you find something like that. Now, chapter 3, verses 14 through 18. There's one more verse after that. It's verse 19, kind of like the farewell. But this is chapter 3, verses 14 through 18. And in these verses, you can see right here, there's three things. These are basically telling Nineveh, there's nothing you can do. As far as preparing, prepare. How do you prepare? There's nothing you can do. You cannot prepare for this. Next, how about your troops, your military? You have a number of troops, or what can you do? It's like you can't find enough troops to stop God's wrath. And then chapter 3, 17 through 18, what about your leaders, your kings, your officials? We'll just say officials. There's different word ways it's translated. Sometimes it's translated princes, or then the next word is scribes or captains or generals. No matter. And again, they're going to be as numerous as locusts. They're going to be as numerous as grasshoppers. In other words, by this time, and this just makes sense, they're not lean, you know, lean, mean fighting machine. Here, they're a lean, mean fighting machine back here. By this time, everybody's got a title. Everybody's got a position. Everybody's royalty. Everybody's got some kind. Everybody's got some kind of degree. And so they're as numerous as locusts and grasshoppers. But it's like they're nothing. There's just so many of them. But you can say everybody's a prince. You can say everybody's a judge. You can give everybody a title, but there's not. You can't do enough of it. Okay, so here we go. Again, these verses, and we're not going to take time, I thought about it, but if you remember Sennacherib, and I think I mentioned this a while ago too, Sennacherib in 701 came to Jerusalem, and he was in Lachish, like we see on these panels. This is battle at Lachish, just southwest of Jerusalem. He's finishing up his last fortress in Judah, and he sends his field marshal up to the walls of Jerusalem and taunts the people, taunts Hezekiah, taunts the Lord. It's like, here's what we're going to do. This right here, these verses 14 through 18 are in a sense the Lord, Yahweh, taunting the Assyrians, just like they taunted him at the walls of Jerusalem. He's now, through this letter, through this prophecy, through this vision, prophesying his taunt at the walls of Nineveh. There's nothing you can do. You can't prepare. You don't have enough troops. Even though you've got everybody in your cities, an official or a king or a prince or a judge, they're like grasshoppers. That can't stop what's coming. So here we go. Chapter 3, verse 14. The first one about the preparation. Draw water for the siege. Strengthen your forts. Go into the clay. Tread the mortar. Take hold of the brick mold. And so what this is telling them is, okay, you guys, you think you can handle this? We got this. We're mighty Nineveh. Well, you better get some water ready. You better get some. This is Nahum talking in 645, right around here, giving advice to 612 Nineveh, saying, this is coming. You better get some water. Because you're going to have a siege. Now, this siege is only going to take 3 months. Northern Samaria in Israel, under the invasion of the Assyrians, took 3 years before it fell. When Babylon takes Jerusalem at the end, it also took 3 years for Jerusalem to fall. Same thing, it took, the Jewish wars with Rome in 66 to 70 AD was a four-year period. The whole time they weren't at Jerusalem, but it took quite a while. You know, even Masada lasted a long time out in the wilderness. This is going to fall in 3 months, according to the Babylonians' own record. But God is telling them, Nahum's telling them, I've done the math every week, 30-some years ahead of time. You better get your water ready. You're going to need water because the first thing they're going to do is cut off your water supply. Point one on page four under chapter 3, verse 14. The water was to be collected so the people of Nineveh could endure a long siege. Sennacherib, and now you may want to just kind of either be flipping back and forth, looking at, you can just imagine, there's the map of Nineveh. You got the Tigris River running over here. You've got a river running into the Tigris River that runs right through Nineveh. When Sennacherib came and became king, he moved out of Asher, where his father Sargon was king, and made his own palace in Nineveh. When he came there, the people had to wait for rain. The fields were ruined because it was dry. You just had to trust the seasons. He went ahead and built canals, and that's what it says right here. Sennacherib had built an aqueduct system and dug 18 canals to bring water throughout the city. That's what Sennacherib had done to Nineveh. And now, during Ashurbanipal's reign, 681 to 668, we're just talking, 20, 30, 40 years, so it's still functioning. They had plenty of water in the city. And so to tell them, you better get some water ready. It's kind of like, we all have waterfront property. We've got 18 canals. We've got aqueducts. It's like telling the people of West Des Moines, you better get some water ready. It's like, we got waterworks. We got plenty of water. Well, when Babylon, the first thing Babylon does is cut off. They block all the canals. They block all the aqueducts, and they dam it up outside the city. And so there is no water in the city. And the first thing that people realize is, we have no water. Eventually, the Babylonians are going to pull the dams out and just flood the city. And that's coming up. We've already talked about that. So, point two, it says, the Babylonian Chronicles records the military of Babylon and the Medes laid siege to Nineveh between May and July. May, June, July, and it fell. Imagine that. May, June, July. The invasion starts, Memorial Day, and by the end of July, by the time it's time before the state fair, it's over. The short siege, 3-month siege, indicates the weakness of Nineveh, the lack of fortitude of the Ninevites. The fleeing locust, it's coming up here, and I'm going to try to say that. I don't want to forget that, but I put that ahead. Notice this next point. It says, strengthen your defenses. Now, what this is talking about is we just had the picture of the gate up here, but you can see the walls on that map. You've got the walls of the city. Let's say here's the wall of the city. Here's the gate of the city. And this is exactly what happened. Archaeologists have found this. But Nahum is telling him, you better, it says, strengthen your defenses. And so what they began to do at these, they started beating on the walls, the Babylonians. And so where they're beating on the walls, they would take and start trying to build up bricks and build up and prevent it from collapsing or bulging in. Or the gates, and they felt the gates were going to give way, they'd start building up. And this is what, as soon as the siege began, this is what the people of Nineveh began to do. And we're not talking, what they're going to do, it describes it for us right here. We're going to read it. But you got to remember, these walls were not built by, the hard-working middle-class American, looking for employment. They were built by slaves. In this case, the hard-working middle-class Ninevite was, he was prospering. He didn't do anything like this. He was lounging around with the kings and enjoying life and all the merchants. The place is full of merchants. There's money. There's things to buy. They're having the best life now. So if anybody built these walls, the slaves. In fact, as we've read before and mentioned, Ashurbanipal brought some of the kings that had rebelled against him, brought them back, and chained them up by these white gates. And so when he came in and out of the gate, there the king was chained like a guard dog. Some nation's king was chained like a guard dog by the gate. And they could walk by and, mock him or something, or poke him with a stick or whatever. I'm not sure what they did. But there, that was the king. He had kings chained by the gates. So imagine, the people aren't building these walls. The slaves are building them, or the captives are building them. But here it says, you better get some water ready. And the reason for that is they're going to shut off your water supply and all your canals and your aqueducts are dried up. And then you better strengthen your defenses because they're going to break right through these walls. So then he says to them, here's the next line. It says, go into the city, or go into the clay, three things. Go into the clay, tread the mortar, take hold of the brick mold, and go into the clay is literally, and again, it means literally go into the clay. It means get elbow deep in the clay. If you're in the city of Nineveh, you better get knee deep, elbow deep in the clay. You better roll your sleeves up and get in the clay because you got to start making bricks. You got to start. These walls are built, but they're not good enough. You better make another wall. So if you're in Nineveh at this time, the siege begins. Get into the clay. Get in there and get started. And then it says, tread the mortar. And treading the mortar is where you'd get to make the bricks. You have to walk in it and tread it and mix the things together. If it be the straw, like the Egyptians the Hebrews were using straw, mix the water together into the clay so you can shape the bricks. So you're knee deep in it, elbow deep, getting into the clay. Now you're treading the clay. Now these are just think about the average citizen. And then take hold of the brick mold. You're going to have to take all that mud that you've been knee-deep in, digging it out, and now you're treading in it, trying to make it soft so you can get it mixed together. And then you got to take the brick mold in the other hand and start packing bricks. And there's two ways of making bricks. One, they bake the bricks in a kiln, or they sun-dry the bricks. And either way, you'd use a brick mold. So these are the people. What are we going to do? Well, you've got all these things, but you better get some water and you better get knee-deep in mud and clay and start making bricks. You better start walking in it. You better have your hands in it. You better have a brick mold in the other hand and start making bricks because they're going to start kicking your doors in, your gates in, your walls in. They're trying to stop the invasion. Now turn to page 5. I just point out their exhaustion and failed physical ability would be wearing away. This is all they're doing. And you can imagine why this city is going to collapse quickly. Chapter 3, verse 15, I'll read this. There will the fire devour you. And that's part of that admonition. Get in the clay, start treading the mortar, get a brick mold in your hand, because that's where the fire is going to consume you. While you're trying to protect or build up, reinforce your gate, it's going to be burnt, and the bar is going to be burnt, and you're there trying to build bricks up against there to reinforce it. That's where you're going to be consumed with fire. Or the sword is going to cut you off. You are going to get here and start reinforcing this, and this is where you'll get burnt by fire, and this is where the sword is going to cut you down. That's where you're going to die, right there. That's what Nahum is saying in 645, apparently in Judah, speaking to Nineveh. The next point, 2, it says the sword will cut you off. Excavation, this is archaeology now, excavation of gateways in Nineveh have exposed the skeletons of the defenders. Not only is this a Bible verse, not only this is a prophecy of Nahum, you can go over there, and if I paint this picture, this is what they're supposed to be doing. You go over there and excavate the gates, you find skeletons there that were rolled over as the Babylonians came in, because what were they doing? We're making bricks. We're making mud. We're trying to keep them out. Excavation of the gateways in Nineveh have exposed the skeletons of the defenders, strengthening their defenses. I mean, that's in quotes because that's taken out of an archaeological article. They were strengthening their... Why did they die right here? They weren't fighting. They were building. By filling in entryways in the city gate in an attempt to save themselves from the Babylonian invaders, there's nowhere to run. They're in the city. They're surrounded. That's what earlier we read about the chariots going here and there, flashing through the city. It's like that was the invasion of everybody getting in position. That was their attack plan. And now there's nowhere to go. The only thing we can do is just keep building bricks. And that's where they died. I mean, it's amazing. You got archaeology. You've got the prophet. So that's the first phrase right there. Phase. You can't prepare for this. Get some water. It's not going to do you any good. Make some mud bricks. You get knee deep in mud, but while you're trying, that's where you're going to die. You're dying right here. So do the best you can. You better start making bricks, but you're going to die making bricks. Now, you're going to now talk about the different people, the number of troops and different people that you've got there. Chapter 3, verse 16. You increased your merchants more than the stars of the heavens. The locust spreads its wings and flies away. Your princes are like grasshoppers, your scribes like clouds of locusts, settling on the fences in a cold day, But when the sun rises, they fly away, and no one knows where they are. So there's two groups of people. They're going to have the merchants, and you're going to have the princes, or the people with titles. These are the important people. And what you've got is you've got, like, they're like grasshoppers. We'll just say merchants here. They're like the stars, meaning there's so many of them. It says right there, you increase your merchants more than the stars of the heavens. You can say it this way. You build your shopping malls and fill them with more stores than there are stars in the heavens. I mean, that's what they're saying. Merchants, we're talking about shops. We're talking about not just a few shops, not of the necessary shops, but just merchant after merchant after merchant. There's everything, just streets full of merchants like stars in the heaven. Went to Nineveh. It's like, why do we go into Nineveh? We're going shopping. There's just all kinds of stuff there. You increase your merchants more than the stars of the heavens. The locust spreads its wings and flies away. And what is taking place here, the merchants now are called locusts, because what the locusts do is they come when the grass is green, and as soon as the grass is gone, everything's brown, the locusts fly away. So these merchants have come, sometimes by force, sometimes because business is good in Nineveh, and because the grass is green, the aqueducts are running, the canals are full, people are spending. But just like a locust, as soon as things dry up, these merchants fly away. In other words, they're not going to be there in your time of trouble. So these merchants have fled. They've left. They may be those that are running into the mountains, which we're going to talk about. Then it goes on. It says, your princes are like grasshoppers, your scribes like clouds of locusts. Settling on the fences in the day of cold, when the sun rises, they fly away, and no one knows where they are. So we'll just say, what are we going to say right here? We'll just say the important people. Important, that's not a good word. The nobles. And again, this word, I'll give you some Hebrew words, the meanings of it. But these are the ones that are your leaders. That would be a better way, your leaders. These are the people that you can count on. When you need something, you want to trust them to get you through the tough times, these are the people you go to. But they're like grasshoppers. You've got so many important people. They're like locusts also. You've got so many important people there's not just the handful, the lean and mean, these are the guys making decisions. It's like everybody's an important person. But when it comes time to make a decision, we need someone at the gates. We need someone to tell us the Babylonians are coming. Where are they? No. Don't. These important people, these people that are running your government, running your economy behind the scenes, they're pulling all the strings and making sure everything's connected. They're like locusts on a cold day. When a cold day, they all settle down on a fence somewhere, and there's just thousands of them. But soon as it starts to get bad, the sun comes up, it gets too hot, they're all gone. So all the people you're counting on in your society, in your city of Nineveh, that are the important people, the nobles, there's so many of them. Soon as the difficult times come, these guys are gone. And no one knows where they went. These would be an example of the refugees fleeing to the mountains. It's like, these guys know something's coming. Why aren't the shops open? Why are the shops closed? The merchant's gone. It's like, I'm here to make money. All our leaders, we were just here to, take off the top of the money. We're just here to profit ourselves. And now that it comes time to fight the Babylonians, actually, we're fighting for the Babylonians. It's like, what? Where'd they go? Well, they are actually, they're Babylonians. They're actually in league with the Babylonians. They're just here making money. It'd be like if your nation was a prosperous nation making money, and someone from another country comes into your country. Love your country. But soon as things go bad, well, I'm not really a member of your country. I'm over here. It's like the money's gone. We're gone. I thought you were part of our country. You wanted equal part of our country. It's like, no, I was here. I was just here for the money. Soon as it gets hot, they're like, everybody's here like on the wall, like locusts on a cold day. But as soon as the heat gets on, boom, they all fly away. Where'd they go? Where are all these people that, well, we want equal rights, we want our share, we want part of the American dream. We don't want it. It's a nightmare. We're gone. Kind of interesting. I mean, I'm just reading text of Scripture. I shouldn't have said America. Sorry. Your princes are like grasshoppers. Your scribes are like clouds of locusts settling on a fence on a cold day. When the sun rises, they fly away. No one knows where they are. Here's now at the bottom of page 5. The word princes is Minarzer. You can pronounce it however you'd like to, because I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's Minnezar, referring to a crowned royalty wearing a diadem. So this is someone that's got a diadem, someone that's been given to them, a ruler's crown. This is the king, but the officials, or this is not the king. See, I forgot the word not. This is the king. That's wrong. This is not the king, but officials under the king. These are people that Ashurbanipal and those who followed him put in positions. You've got all these people of dignitary. You're this person. You're in charge of this. You're in charge of all these positions of government positions, bureaucracy they've built. Everybody's got a position. That's what that word means. They're crowned officials. They've been given some place in the government. Two, the word scribes, or it could be the word generals, or it could be the word captains. It's the word tipsar. The people in leadership with authority. These are as numerous as locusts. So that's that group right there. These are the merchants, the leaders, all these people that are here for power or for money, merchandise, you know, the merchants. When this day comes, all the people there for power are gone. All the people there to sell and make money, they're gone. All that's left is your people. Chapter 3, verse 18. Your shepherds are asleep, O king of Assyria. Now, this is Nahum talking to the king of Assyria. If he's writing in 645, it'd be Ashurbanipal. But, you know, in the event, it'd be Sin-shar-ishkun. He died. They say, no one knows exactly what happened, but some people assume that he killed himself in the palace. He just went up in flames. He just burned with the palace. Your shepherds are asleep, O king of Assyria. Your nobles slumber. And now when it says asleep, it may mean, I mean right there, asleep or slumber. It may mean they're not alert. They did not see this coming. But as we look at the locusts fleeing and the grasshoppers fleeing, you have the impression someone saw it coming. People that were in the know knew it was coming and sold all their stocks. They got out of the market ahead of time. So that may not mean no one saw it coming. It's not a surprise attack. I mean, we'd see it coming because, you know, Nabopolassar went up the Euphrates. He went up the Tigris. The fortresses are falling like ripe fruit. So it's not like they're surprised. It could be. It's possible, he's saying to the king of Assyria, your shepherds are asleep, your nobles slumber. It may be a reference to death. They're dead. Your shepherds are dead. Your nobles are dead. King, what are you going to do? They've killed everybody. Everybody that you were counting on is dead. Either they didn't know it was coming, so you got to decide which way you're going to go with that. But here's the follow-up. He's talking to the king. He addresses the king. King, your shepherds and your nobles are asleep. They're slumbering. Or at least they look like they are. Maybe they're dead. And your people, where are your people? Those that didn't get killed are corpses in the street. Your people are scattered to the mountains. And that's exactly, if you look at Nineveh, you can see with the water, the Tigris River, that's water flowing out of the mountains. And so the people would have fled up into the mountains. That's what history records. They just fled, just vanished, just got out. They're refugees. That's how this whole chapter or this whole night started when we started talking about that. Your shepherds are asleep, O king of Assyria. Your nobles slumber. Your peoples are scattered on the mountains with no one to gather them. They're never coming back because you are dead, and they're going to run to Haran and set up a new king and a new government in Haran trying to rebuild the Assyrian Empire, which is not going to work. And there, I've got that written down right there. Your people are scattered. In six, I'll just read 2a. In 612 BC, the survivors fled to the mountains for survival, and the shambles of the Assyrian government fled west to Haran until they were forced to flee to Carchemish in 610, where they were finally completely eliminated in 605 BC. Assyria was absorbed into the Babylonian Empire after 605, which it was itself absorbed into the Persian Empire in 538. By that time, the Greeks marched through the Middle East to take the Persian Empire. The city of Nineveh could no longer be identified, and the culture itself was ancient history by the time Alexander the Great comes through. We're talking ancient history in Alexander the Great's day. Now the end. Chapter 3, verse 19. A final description of Nineveh's fate and a rhetorical question highlighting their unceasing oppression on the people in the Middle East. Three basic things are said here. There is no easing your hurt. Your wound is grievous. Now, if you're talking about the physical battle, I've got that written down. Point one, medical skills was so limited that even a mild wound would cause death with infection or something. So you're wounded. You're going to die. You're not going to recover. We can do all kinds of things with modern medicine in their case. If that's what it's talking about, it's probably talking more about the Assyrian Empire. There is no easing your hurt. Your wound is grievous. What takes place here in Nineveh is like, this wound is serious. This is not a setback. This is a serious wound. You're never going to recover from this. Now, all who hear the news about you clap their hands over you. So again, we have, you know, the social media, we have internet, we've got the news, we got the networks. So if something happens, if you don't know about it, it's because you're out somewhere in a field somewhere without your phone. Because wherever you're at, you know it instantly. And if you don't see it, someone's going to text you and ask you about it. And so when something happens nowadays, everybody knows it. In these days, you can imagine the Battle of Nineveh the information would have to spread, you know, going down to Thebes. It'd take 1,600 miles. It's going to take, you know, several weeks for it to travel that far. But the point here is, all who hear of it, it's going to spread. The knowledge of the fall of Nineveh is going to spread. And everybody who hears it, every wave of information, every new city that hears it, their reaction is going to be, yeah, yes. What that means right there, they'll clap your hand. What's that mean? What does it mean in the ancient world when people would like clap their hand? What it means this. It means, yeah. It means the same thing it means today. They're applauding. People going, yeah, Nineveh's fallen. Finally. And why would they respond like that? I mean, this was Nineveh the Great. It was a beautiful city. These were great kings. They had a great military. Well, here's why. For upon whom has not come your unceasing evil? All these people, why are they clapping? Because where on this map has a person, people not been affected by your evil? I mean, the very fact you've got all this plunder back in your city. You went 1,600 miles to destroy Thebes, and then you drug back drug back monuments and gates and gold, and that was just Thebes. All these other places, everyone on that map has been plundered by you, or you've been forcing them to pay tribute. You've been taking their best people, their best goods, and everybody's glad to see you fall. Why? Because you've spread your evil everywhere. How evil? Well, God just pouring out his wrath on you. That's how evil. So, I mean, the people are cheering for God's wrath coming on Nineveh. Now, it looks like a historical event. But with Nahum's announcement, it's not just a historical event. It's the wrath of God being poured out on the city of Nineveh. And how evil were they? So evil that the people of the world are glad to see that it's finally over. And so that's the end of the book of Nineveh. There's no easing your hurt, meaning this is never going to come back. Your wound is grievous. All who hear the news about you clap their hands, for upon whom has not come your unceasing evil? And that's how the book ends. Upon whom has not come your unceasing evil? That's the end of the book. And the answer is, no, everyone's experienced this. Now, again, the interesting thing here is as this wraps up right here, this is the Assyrians. They're going to be followed by the Babylonian Empire. And each of these empires, Daniel is soon going to, right here, right when Nineveh falls in 612, Carchemish is 605, and that's when 605, are you with me? 612, Nineveh falls. The government runs over to Haran, and that falls in 610. The remnant runs over to Carchemish, and in 605, Nebuchadnezzar, who's leading his father's military now, General Nebuchadnezzar defeats the Assyrians and Egypt at Carchemish in 605, and that's when he comes down through Israel pursuing Pharaoh Necho into Egypt and gets news that his father Nabopolassar has died, and Nebuchadnezzar turns around and goes back to Babylon to secure, because he's now the new king. Him or his brother, and he's got to make sure his brother doesn't get it, so he's the new king. That's when he takes Daniel captive, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and all the royal children, he takes them back in 605. So Daniel now in 605, just a few years after 612, Daniel is in Babylon. And that's when he starts having, the, you know, he's going to have the dream, or Nebuchadnezzar is going to have the dream of the beast, and all these events are taking place. The point there is those empires, Babylon, then Persia and Greece and Rome, were all called beast. They were all beasts. Even in the book of Revelation, we talk about beast. We can assume that Assyria would be a beast also, although it was before Daniel was calling him beast. But again, what's interesting about this is this makes it very clear Assyria has fallen. They're never coming back. They're gone. And it was that way, and this may give a little bit of insight into prophecy, potentially. Babylon is going to fall. Persia is going to fall. Greece is going to fall. But then that fourth beast of that vision, which would be the fifth if you count Assyria, but in the vision it was the fourth beast. It would be the sixth if you count Egypt. The sixth beast, or the fourth beast of Daniel's vision, was different than the other beast. Now, how is it different? It may be that it comes back. It's going to be have that wounded head that recovers, and everyone's going to be astonished when they see it. And so that would be Rome. Assyria's gone, Babylon's gone, Persia's gone, Greece is gone, but Rome, or whatever that beast was, it's going to resurface. And that would be then the seventh beast, or we talk about in Revelation, you got the 10 heads, the 7 horns, and all these things. You've got 7 empires, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, and then revised Rome, the Babylonian, or the Antichrist kingdom, which would be the 7 kingdoms. Anyway, just right there, this is one of those, not of Daniel's prophecy, but one of the beasts that precede the Antichrist kingdom. And this is, again, very similar language to how the Antichrist kingdom will fall in the future. I'll pray. Next week, we move into the book of Zephaniah. If you want to have a heads up, again, I tell you that because I'm excited about it, but also as a fair warning, that's what we're going to be doing next week. But we just finished Nineveh right here, or Nahum right here, and then Zephaniah is going to come around 624. So Zephaniah will be talking right as the Babylonians are rising, but Nineveh's completely weak. Or Assyrians are weak, but it's before the fall of Nineveh, if we place it 624. After Zephaniah, will go to the book of Habakkuk, which is probably right around 606. Realize Zephaniah's writing during the time of Jeremiah and Josiah. Josiah's just beginning his reform. Jeremiah's prophesying, so Zephaniah's right there in line with him. Zephaniah's going to do a lot of work with, and we get a lot of information about, the day of the Lord. That's the phrase, day of the Lord, is a big thing in Zephaniah. And he'll talk about current prophecy, but also future eschatological events. I'll pray, and we'll be done. Father, we thank you for your truth. We thank you for your word. We do ask that we would handle these things diligently, that we'd consider our own lives, not just the lives of other nations and empires, but, Father, our own selves, that we would walk in a way that is pleasing to you, that we would walk away from the wrath and into your grace and into your love and mercy, that we would, again, grow in Christ and become the people you want us to be at this time in history, in this fallen age, that we would shine like lights. In Jesus' name we ask this. Amen. Thank you for your time. I appreciate you being here.